This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. On the Down East Journal today, we delve into the issue of sex trafficking. This story contains descriptions that some listeners may find upsetting. Human trafficking, whether labor or sex trafficking, is defined as holding a person in involuntary servitude by force, coercion, or debt bondage. And although an alarming number of cases have been reported around the world, in the United States, and right here in eastern North Carolina, it's difficult to accurately count the number of victims because the illicit activity is done covertly. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, between 2008 and 2010, federal anti-trafficking task forces opened more than 2,500 suspected cases of human trafficking. Of those, 82% were classified as sex trafficking. The fact is, women and young girls are more likely to be coerced into the sex trade, but boys can be victims too.
They have been sold for sex every single night of the week, as many times as maybe up to 30.
Anna Smith is the executive director and co-founder of Restore One.
These boys have been performing sexual acts, whether if it's intercourse, it could be pornography, it could be stripping. They've been beaten, starved, afraid for their life.
According to Anna, an estimated 300,000 youth are brought into the sex trade every year in America. Half of those kids are boys.
These boys will last no longer than 6 years is the estimate once they are initially recruited by a pimp into the sex trade. These boys have traveled all across the United States. They've been listed online for sex. What they've endured is high levels of trauma while in the sex trade, but also majority of these boys will have past history of sexual abuse even before being recruited by a pimp into the sex trade.
Restore One, a Greenville-based nonprofit, is dedicated to providing restorative care to adolescent males who are victims of sex trafficking. The organization will soon open the first shelter in the nation for males ages 12 to 18.
Often we don't think that happens to them. We don't hear a lot about in the news, but there's not a lot of services out there for men and boys. And so with that said, there's a grave need for that type of care, not just within our state having a lot of human trafficking, but also nationwide.
Restore One has assisted in local and national cases of male human trafficking. Anna says, until now, there has been no safe homes specifically for male victims of domestic minor sex trafficking and commercial sexual exploitation in the United States. After about a year of searching, persistence paid off, and Restore One is breaking ground this fall on their 8,500-square-foot facility called Anchor House. President and co-founder Chris Smith says the journey so far hasn't been a smooth one.
We found land that was donated by someone, but when the lawyers sat down to deed the land over, it just did not work out, so we lost that land. We signed on another piece of land that was 10 acres, and it ended up not being able to work out because it couldn't hold septic tanks, so that didn't work out either. Last week, we finally have now signed on land that is 10 acres. We will build an anchor house on that piece of land.
The facility will be located somewhere in eastern North Carolina, but Chris says the exact location will remain undisclosed.
The boys that will be staying in our home will actually be testifying against their perpetrators or their pimps. So for that reason, we won't be able to release the home at all. It's kind of more like a domestic violence shelter also, so we won't be releasing the location of the home just for the safety of the boys.
Anchor House will be constructed in three phases. Phase one includes a cottage that will accommodate four boys and adult caregivers and a community building with a basketball gym, cafeteria, and a classroom.
The boys will be homeschooled on site there. It has a nursing station, it has a library and a counseling room. It also has a living room. Then upstairs it has enough room for three interns to live with a small living space.
Phase two will mean a second cottage, and phase three will include an additional cottage. The total cost of the project is approximately $1 million. When Anchor House is fully finished, it will accommodate 12 boys. Restore One's executive director, Anna Smith, admits it's just a drop in the bucket as far as the amount of boys needing this type of care.
So we will take in boys from all across the nation, and we'll begin the process of bringing them back their life that they had lost after they were trafficked. We never know what type of investment that will be not in their life, but also the people that they will affect along the way.
In order to meet the psychological, physical, and sociological needs of the adolescent male victims, Restore One's advisory board and executive directors will carefully select the boys who will receive care at Anchor House after a detailed application is completed and a psychological evaluation is conducted. If Anchor House proves successful, Anna says they plan to share this model with other organizations that also want to impact male trafficking victims. Restore One is hosting their second annual Stand for One Gala next weekend. The event will include dinner, live music, guest speakers, and a silent auction to raise funds for Anchor House.
It's at Rock Spring Center in Greenville, North Carolina on September the 26th at 7 p.m. We're really excited to say that we're fully funded to build the Anchor House debt-free. And so what the funds will be going towards from the gala that are raised are, once we're open, you know, what does it cost to keep a program like this open?
Anchor House is set to break ground in November. It could take 6 to 8 months for phase one to be complete. For more information on Restore One and the Stand for One Gala, visit publicradioeast.org. Conservators with the Queen Anne's Revenge Project have utilized new X-ray technology to further efforts to preserve artifacts brought up from the wreck site of the pirate Blackbeard's flagship. George Olson has more.
Literally thousands and thousands of artifacts have been brought up off the ocean floor since the 1996 discovery of the Queen Anne's Revenge. Some of the items that come up are easily identifiable, others, not so much.
Most objects that come up, aside from the anchors and cannons that have a very diagnostic shape, come up as an amorphous blob, and there's no way to tell just by looking at something what's inside it. And that's why the X-ray is so important to our task here, because that helps us determine what's inside it and what needs maybe more conservation attention or what is more diagnostically interesting for the archaeologist to study.
Kimberly Kenyon, a conservator with the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab in Greenville. She was speaking to me back in April of this year in advance of the lab using a new X-ray technology to better understand what was encased inside those amorphous blobs. The lab has used conventional 2D X-ray technology to try and decipher what exactly is inside a concreted artifact. Over the summer, they plan to try out 3D X-ray technology being used at Davidson College. They completed their scans last month with positive results.
I think the most distinctive artifact that came out of this exercise was one that we had x-rayed before, and we could make out some faint details on the object, and we theorized from that that it might be a coin, and then we were able to use that with Davidson's imaging technology, and they were able to actually verify that it is a coin, and because they're essentially, 3D technology is more like a CT scan. It could scan through the artifact, and they were able to isolate the two different faces of the coin, and we were able to identify what type of coin it is.
The 3D couldn't quite provide enough detail to indicate when the coin was struck, but provided enough detail to indicate it's similar to a coin that was earlier recovered from the wreck site and now on display at the Beaufort Maritime Museum. So what you've got is 3D showing what was thought to be a coin was actually a coin. On the surface, so what? But for a conservationist, getting that detail, indicating that what you have is likely a silver coin similar to one previously recovered, indicates how to proceed.
The corrosion products that occur on silver are a completely different nature than those which occur on iron. So whereas the iron involves a lot of mechanical removal, the silver involves a chemical reduction process to get the corrosion products back to a metallic state. Because essentially all that silver has migrated out into the concretion, so we need to get it back into the coin.
The 3D also provided some proof that even pirates have to do a little field engineering to keep a ship running.
We did x-ray one hand tool, and those are unique objects in that we don't have many of them, but they're, you know, a specific tool that was in use on the ship, so those are always interesting for us to work on. We did x-ray that one with Davidson, and they were able to basically help us see details within the concretion that we can't necessarily tell in our x-ray films. And what they found was that there was what appears to be a small additional piece of iron wedged into the handle of the tool that looks like some kind of modification during its use. So maybe that tool broke in the past and was remodified so that they could keep using it.
Kimberly Kenyon called the 3D imaging software an incredible tool for their conservation process. Still, there were some disappointments. Kenyon says they were able to get images on about 10 items. However, some especially weighty concretions were immune, so to speak, from the 3D X-ray process.
It was more of a limitation of the imaging plates that they could use. There are, I think, larger, more powerful plates that can take a higher amount of radiation exposure. But because you need such a high amount of radiation to penetrate the really dense concretions, you need a plate that can accept that radiation as well. And that's where we're limited with this experiment.
But now they know, meaning future 3D look-sees at artifacts coming off the Beaufort Harbor floor might reveal more detailed secrets sooner rather than later. Kimberly Kenyon is a conservator with the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab in Greenville. I'm George Olson.
A small fire was reported at the Greenville Homeless Shelter early Friday morning. Residents were evacuated, and one person was sent to the hospital. According to WITN, crews are still working to determine the cause of the fire. The blaze happens the same week as plans were announced to open a new homeless shelter. A groundbreaking ceremony was held Tuesday. Executive Director Bob Williams says the current shelter was built in 1953 and needs to be replaced.
Obviously, a building that old, it just isn't structurally adequate anymore. There are leaks in the roof that we're repairing weekly. There's maintenance issues that we're taking care of on a weekly basis. So it just is not a functional building anymore.
Williams says they are currently at maximum capacity with only 74 beds. The new facility will be able to accommodate 110 people.
We've incorporated 4 family rooms into the new shelter so that families can stay together. Residents will have a men's side, women's side on the other area, a very large dining hall, a commercial kitchen, and a lounge area where they can kind of hang out and do whatever they want in the evening.
The funds raised for the $2.2 million facility came from grants and donations from local members of the community. The new shelter, which will be located behind the current shelter, is expected to be operational in summer of 2015.
I'm Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, here with this week's edition of the Garden Journal. Today I want to talk about protecting pollinators. Honeybee populations have declined worldwide in recent years, and many gardeners are coming to understand that protecting pollinator insects, particularly honeybees but native bees as well, is increasingly important. 3/4 of the Earth's flowering plants rely on insects or animals to carry out pollination, including 1/3 of the world's food crops. Many fruit and vegetable crops rely on insect pollinators, things like apples, blueberries, strawberries, cucumbers, and squash all require insect pollinators. Several factors have been identified in insect population decline, including parasites and diseases, poor nutrition, habitat loss, pesticides, and environmental stress. While we can't address all of these issues, gardeners should recognize the importance of pollinator insects and can take steps to protect pollinators in and around the garden. Honeybees are the most well-known pollinator. They are native to Europe and are often managed for pollination in gardens and agricultural crops because they form colonies and are excellent pollinators, often flying 2 or more miles from the hive. Native pollinators, while less well-known, play an important role as well. There are over 4,000 species of native bees in the United States. Native bees are also valuable crop pollinators. While they don't range as far as honeybees, native bees are very efficient and can be more active in inclement weather than honeybees. Native bees also play an important role pollinating wild plants and sustaining native ecosystems. The greater the diversity of bees in an area, the better the pollination will be. While research has focused on protecting honeybees, the same steps that protect honeybees will also protect native bees. So what steps can gardeners take to protect pollinator insects in their yards? First, use pesticides sparingly and only as needed. Pesticides include insecticides, chemicals that kill insects, fungicides, chemicals that control fungi, herbicides, chemicals that kill plants, and miticides, chemicals used to kill mites. While it seems apparent that insecticides are a threat to bees, other pesticides can also be toxic to bees. So make sure that you have plant problems accurately diagnosed prior to applying a pesticide. Utilize integrated pest management practices prior to resorting to chemical pest control. Build healthy soils. Choose the right plant for the right location. Practice good sanitation and optimum watering to help reduce plant problems in the landscape. The use of hand-picking, row covers, and fostering beneficial insects can also help reduce pest pressures in the garden. Next week, we'll talk about additional steps you can take to protect and encourage pollinators in your garden. I'm Lisa Rayburn, horticulture agent with Onslow County Cooperative Extension, with this week's edition of The Garden Journal.
Whether you're a master gardener or just developing your green thumb, you can help us cultivate The Garden Journal by sending us your ideas for future episodes. Just go to publicradioeast.org and click on the skybox on the right-hand side of the homepage. There, you'll be able to send us a message. Please include your name, where you're from, and your ideas for gardening topics you'd like discussed. The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members and partnership with Marie Phillips, mortgage professional with First Citizens Bank in downtown New Bern, specializing in home loans for purchases, refinances, and construction loans. Marie Phillips, 252-637-8222. If your business, professional practice, or organization is planning a media campaign, consider the Public Radio East audience. For information about business sponsorships, call Mike Foster at 1-800-222-9832.
I'm Mary Beth Seidenfield, and I'm the volunteer coordinator at Public Radio East. I would like to encourage you to join the family of volunteers. We are a very diverse, friendly group of people who enjoy working with the staff at the radio station, enjoy the fact that our input counts. Our major job is mailings before our fund drives. And these mailings are very important. They account for about 50% of the funds that come in. So I'm going to encourage you to perhaps join us. You will find you will make some new friends, learn some interesting things, and help the station's finances. Our next mailing starts on September 22nd. And if you would like to join us, you can go to publicradioeast.org/volunteer.
As you're traveling around eastern North Carolina this weekend, you may notice individuals or groups of people picking up trash along the highway. That's because the statewide fall litter sweep is underway. This week, I spoke with marketing specialist with the North Carolina Department of Transportation, Julia Casadante, about the cleanup campaign and about how you can get involved.
We have hundreds of volunteers come out from many different organizations across the state, including groups that have adopted a section of highway, our DOT maintenance crews. We have some Department of Public Safety inmate crews helping out, as well as groups like churches or, you know, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, universities, and just different volunteer organizations that want to help clean up North Carolina.
The fall litter sweep starts this weekend. Is it too late to join in and be a part of this?
It's not. It goes for a whole two-week period from September 20th to October 4th.
Where can you get cleanup supplies and what types of things will they give you?
Your local county maintenance office, your local NCDOT county maintenance office will provide vests and bags. And when the groups are finished, they're just need to contact the maintenance office again. They'll come pick up the trash. But we encourage people to, you know, just wear closed-toed shoes, you know, certainly if they're wading through, you know, grass or anything like that. So.
Now, it is cooling off here in eastern North Carolina, but probably not a bad idea to bring some water with you, too, right?
Oh, yes. Make sure to stay hydrated, and we actually have some safety guidelines, available on the website as well. So it's just ncdot.gov / and then a tilde, one of those, squiggly things with a litter sweep.
It is picking up trash, but one way you can make that really fun is with the unusual litter contest. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we love it. That contest is actually sponsored by Keep North Carolina Beautiful. They should have some more information about that available on their website. But I think it's a $250 prize for whoever takes a picture and sends it in of the most unusual piece of litter that they find. In the past, we've had discoveries of, old coins, I think a diamond one time, some false teeth, just really all across the board. So it's an interesting way to sort of put a little different twist on it.
Have you picked up any unusual litter yourself?
I have fortunately not, but I'm sure if I looked harder, I would be able to.
Is there anything else that you can tell us about the fall litter sweep?
We certainly encourage people to come out and participate. Volunteers are critical to this effort. They help remove 1 to 2 million pounds of trash each litter sweep, which are held the last 2 weeks of September and April. So just keeps our state looking better and helps keep North Carolina beautiful.
Great. Well, Julia, thank you so much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Yes, definitely, Jared. Anytime.
For more information on the statewide fall litter sweep, call 1-800-331-5864. September is the 25th year of National Recovery Month, promoting the benefits of prevention, treatment, and recovery for mental and substance use disorders. Today, we hear the inspiring story of a local man who struggled with years of depression and alcohol abuse, but overcame through the help of faith, family, and a positive outlook on the future.
My name is Leroy. I started drinking when I was about 19, 20, having fun. My alcohol intake increased when I joined the military, and especially while I was training for my tour of duty in Vietnam. After my tour in Vietnam, my habit increased even more. Everything was a celebration, promotion, holidays, sports wins or losses, including those events which I am not proud of, DUIs, DWIs, fights, tiredness from work. Even those events created a time to celebrate with alcohol, whether I won or whether I lost. In 1987, my alcohol consumption really increased. I was stationed in Okinawa, Japan. There wasn't too much else to do but drink. I lived for a bottle and cared about nothing else. It came to a halt when I was a driver of a vehicle. Yeah, and I was intoxicated, and I had an accident that really hurt someone. I even killed someone. After that incident, my command referred me to a Navy doctor, who in turn referred me to alcohol rehab for 8 weeks. From day one, I was in denial, and that was the first and the hardest thing I had to admit. I realized that I was an alcoholic. My road to recovery, it was very hard to do. I was under surveillance. You were somewhat branded. Everyone looking for you to slip. Even I was conscious of slipping each day and remained that way even today. One thing that I had to do was eliminate the triggers and recognize them. Once I did that, I had to reinforce on what was important to me, my career, my family, my health, the health and welfare of others, and, of course, God. Let me elaborate. I was able to get promoted on time and completed 30 years of service with honorable discharge. My family, I was able to concentrate more on providing a future for my children, which resulted in my 3 kids completing college, all with master's degrees and with very accomplished careers. My wife, who supported me 100% during my recovery, We will celebrate our 46 years anniversary, marriage anniversary, in December. And there is no doubt in my mind that our marriage would have lasted that long if I was still consuming alcohol. The welfare of others, basically, is not to take the life of others through being mischievous or driving a vehicle and causing a motor accident. And finally, I'd like to thank God for the blessing and the power he bestowed upon me to prevail. My name is Leroy. I am now 60 years old. I've been alcohol free for 26 years.
For more information on National Recovery Month, go to recoverymonth.gov.